This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The Boston Police Department could and should have done more to protect the public after Officer Patrick Rose was accused of sexually abusing a child in 1995. That is the finding of a new, highly anticipated report from the city's new Office of Police Accountability and Transparency. Instead, Rose was allowed to return to duty, and he ascended to lead the powerful Patrolmen's Union before retiring in 2018. Rose stands now accused of 33 criminal counts against at least six children. He was arrested last August. Here is acting Boston Mayor Kim Janey releasing the report earlier this afternoon.
The failure to fully implement the reforms recommended in 1992 was a missed opportunity with very tragic results. In 2021, we have an obligation to ensure this never happens again.
WBUR's Allie Jarmanning is covering this story, joins us now. Allie, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So, Allie, this report is about what went wrong, and with the case of Patrick Rose, why someone accused of assaulting a child in 1995 was allowed to remain on the force for over two decades and work with vulnerable minors. So what does it say about what went wrong?
So it says that the police department's internal affairs investigators were slow to act after Patrick Rose was charged with sexually abusing a child. They let the criminal investigation play out and didn't even interview Rose about the allegations until a year after he was charged. And this went directly against what the police department was told just a few years before in what's known as the St. Clair Report. That's what Acting Mayor Janey was referring to about 1992. And that report made clear that the police should not wait for the criminal investigation to end before taking action. But in the Rose case, by the time the internal affairs investigators got around to investigating, the victim in the case had been pressured to recant and the charges were dropped against Rose. The city's review released today also finds that the department could have fired Rose, but it's not clear that any discipline was taken against him other than the fact that he was on desk duty for 2 years. And he spent two more decades with the police department, eventually leading the patrolmen's union, as you said, and allegedly abusing other kids.
All right. So in addition to the findings about Rose, the report also makes recommendations. What are those and how do they get implemented?
Right. So to back up a bit, there have been a lot of recommendations over the past year to fix the Boston Police Department. The formation of this watchdog agency that did this report, OPAT, is actually one of them. And the city in their report today pointed to many of the reforms that the city ordinance already recommended that will help prevent issues like this going forward. Things like creating clearer discipline expectations for certain misconduct. And the police commissioner would have to follow those recommendations or say in writing why they're deviating from them. There are a couple of new recommendations that come out of this review. One is investigations should begin within 48 hours of IA being notified, and it recommends that OPAT get flagged whenever a police officer is charged with a crime. That doesn't happen right now. It's up to the city, though, to put these measures in place, but so far it's been slow going. Even this report on Rose was delivered a month later than initially planned. In addition to the pace, though, you know, I'm really going to be watching to see whether the promise to make these allegations and investigations, quote unquote, visible actually means that we'll see names of officers, charges against them, and discipline handed down.
Okay, so there is very little here, Allie, about this blue wall of silence, as it's called, culture of silence, or individual supervisors willfully turning a blind eye. The role of the police union isn't even mentioned. It is very much about systems and clarity of rules. Did that tone surprise you, and did those absences surprise you?
Yeah, I think a number of people were surprised that we didn't really learn a ton new in this report. There were no new facts of what happened or who was responsible. Janey did say today that everyone who was in charge back then has since left the department, leaving them seemingly above any discipline. Now, City Councilor Andrea Campbell, who is running for mayor against Janey, she spoke to the press right after Janey did outside City Hall, and she said the city should be digging deeper into what happened back then. Unless they've since died, she says they should be held accountable.
So, biggest takeaway, Allie, from today in this report?
Yeah, you know, when this happened, the city was just a few years out from the St. Clair report. And that report found that the internal affairs process in Boston was a mess, half-hearted, shoddy investigations with lots of delays. And yet, even just a few years after that, the department still seems to have bungled the investigation into Rose for one of the most heinous crimes you can be accused of. And they still didn't do what they were supposed to do. So that kind of gives me some pause about what we're seeing now. So just like in the early 90s, there's so much attention on the police department right now. We just had a task force come out with their recommendations. And there's this promise that these things won't happen again. But as we've seen, that doesn't always mean the problems get fixed. And it can have pretty disastrous consequences for our most vulnerable people.
Okay, we're going to follow up on that task force momentarily. But before I let you go, Allie, what happens now?
So for Patrick Rose, we wait to see what happens with his criminal case. He is still in jail and has not yet gone to trial. And for the police department, we really just have to wait and see if what's being promised actually makes it into practice or if it'll be a repeat of what we saw in the 90s.
Okay, WBUR reporter Allie Germanning. Allie, thank you.
Thank you.
And before I turn to our next guest, I do want to note that we invited Acting Boston Police Commissioner Gregory Long to join us today, but he declined. We also reached out to the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association for comment, but didn't receive a response. All right, now, listening into that conversation was Javier Flores. He was a member of the Boston Police Reform Task Force, which Allie Germanning mentioned a moment ago, and is a partner at Dinsmore & Scholl. Javier, welcome back to Radio Boston. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So let's start sort of broadly. I'll ask you your reactions to the report today.
Well, I think, you know, it's disappointing because we really don't know a lot more about what occurred back in 1996 than we did before. What we do know, however, is that there was a finding by the IAD that there was sufficient evidence to support allegations in the complaint made against Mr. Rose. And on that basis, you know, it's extremely concerning that Mr. Rose was not only returned to full duty, but allowed to interact with members of the public. It seemed that if the IAD determined that there was evidence to support the allegations, then at a minimum, he should have been restricted in his duties if permitted to continue with the BPD and likely should have been terminated.
So you said it was disappointing. What might you have expected to learn in the report that we didn't, and why might that not be there?
Well, it's difficult to say what to expect because, you know, in this case, there has to be significant considerations given to protecting the victim. We want to encourage victims of abuses to come forward and expose these types of issues. And I expect that the mayor's office was unable to release additional details without potentially uncovering who the victim was in this case.
So you were part of the reform task force that led to the creation of this Office of Police Accountability and Transparency, or OPAT. You know, I just wonder, was this the reason for OPAT doing this type of work? Is this type of investigation what you had in mind?
Not exactly. I mean, yes and no. OPAT was designed to provide, you know, accountability and transparency to IAD investigations. And that's essentially what was done here. However, this was more of an evaluation, it seems to me, of the policies and procedures, which is also within the realm of OPAT. But we expected it more to be ongoing and looking at cases as they're arising to ensure that there's justice for victims who are currently, you know, who have submitted complaints to the police department or raised allegations of abuses. You know, looking at a case that's 25 years old presents significant challenges, and I think it's great that the OPAT was there to provide this type of oversight, but it's not directly in line with what was intended.
So I'm hearing you sort of say this is office that should be looking at what's happening today, providing transparency and accountability today. There are some lessons that were learned from looking back at 95 that maybe will be helpful. This report has a series of recommendations. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you is, so what happens now? Are there teeth in these recommendations? Does anybody have to do anything based on the recommendations placed in this report?
Not really. There's not a whole lot of teeth. You know, the mayor has made a commitment to adopting the changes that are set forth in the report. And, you know, the mayor has expressed an interest, certainly a desire to see this change enforced, citing the lack of institution of the recommendations being made by the St. Clair Commission in 1992. So hopefully we don't see an instance of history repeating itself. But I think it's also important to remember that, you know, we're focused on the issue related to Patrick Rose, but police reform is a much broader issue. And we can't just be caught up in implementation of the changes set forth in this report. There's a broader focus, a broader set of changes that were recommended by the Police Reform Commission. And all of those changes need to be implemented and implemented in a timely basis to really get the outcome that was intended.
We're talking with Javier Flores, who was a member of the Boston Police Reform Task Force. You talked about police reform. You may have heard me ask Ali Jarmaning about this missing theme, or what felt missing as a reader of the report, about the culture of silence, the blue wall of silence, the culture of taking care of each other inside the police force. And it's not in that report, but it is a theme that has come up consistently in conversations about police reform here in Boston. So did it surprise you not to have that dimension come up? And what do you expect, or what could one expect OPAT to be able to do about that culture?
Well, I think there's two things to consider. One is, without knowing what went into this investigation in 1996, it's hard to draw any real conclusions about what type of silence may have contributed to this. However, you know, we do obviously know that this has been a recurring issue over the years within the BPD. I think that in order to get the type of change we need, there needs to be continued focus on education, continued development of the policies and procedures to ensure that there's equity and that there's fairness and transparency, so we can have some accountability within the BPD and have a community base that feels confident that the BPD is being held accountable for what, you know, for their transgressions. Also, you know, we can't expect change without changes in leadership. If we have the same leaders in place, then we should expect the same policies and procedures and the same culture to be maintained. And that takes time.
And I do, again, want to note that we reached out to Acting Boston Police Commissioner Gregory Long to join us, but he declined. Just in a sentence, Javier, are you hopeful about the future of meaningful police reform in Boston?
Yes, I think that there is a blueprint that's been laid out by the Boston Police Reform Commission, and to the extent that it's adopted in a timely and effective manner, then yes, I am hopeful.
That is Javier Flores. He was a member of the Boston Police Reform Task Force and is a partner at Dinsmore and Scholl. Javier, I appreciate you joining us again today on Radio Boston.
Thank you.
The thought of space travel and exploration have ignited our sense of wonder and inspired us to reach for the stars for generations, from our real-life triumphs.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
To the stories we like to tell.
Well, we used to look up in the sky and wonder at our place in the stars.
The universe is a pretty big place. It's bigger than anything anyone has ever dreamed of before.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise.
And now a new age of space travel has begun. The age of the billionaire. This month, we saw not one, but two billionaires take flight separately, and even if temporarily, leave our little blue dot behind. Given the responses to their adventures, we are wondering, is the billionaire space race more
to infinity and beyond?
Or...
And now, another controvertible episode of Pigs in Space!
we couldn't resist. And as a place that both billionaires and space travel experts call home, we think Boston is uniquely qualified to weigh in on that question. So we have invited two experts to join us today to talk about it, and we want you to join us too. What do you make of the new billionaire space race? Is it inspiring, or does it make you mad? Are you somewhere in between? Call us. Join the conversation. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. So, to our guests, Marcia Bartuszak is professor of the practice emeritus at MIT and author of several books on astrophysics and astronomy. Marcia, welcome back to the show.
It's so nice to be with you again, Tiziana.
It's great to have you and to have your partner with us, which we do pair you to sometimes, Kelly Beattie, senior editor of Cambridge-based Sky and Telescope. Hey, Kelly, welcome back to you too.
Oh, thank you so much, Tiziana.
All right, let's jump in, and I'm going to encourage you to just both start talking at once. I want to ask you, what did you make of the two space flights by our billionaires earlier this month?
Well, I'm a romantic. I will confess I agree with that introduction you had. I believe it is our destiny to be in space, to really be the caretakers of the solar system. We are explorers, and these are our first steps into the universe, but that's long-term, very long-term. For now, what's happened lately, I'm more practical. The genie is out of the bottle. We're not going back. There will be a commercial presence in space. I wasn't mad because I know that what's happening now with Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic, that's just the tip of the iceberg. It's a sideshow. There are dozens of other companies that are involved in developing cargo transport, rockets, landers, rovers, research craft. They're looking into space manufacturing and mining. Space tourism, this is such a minor part of what's going on. They're sort of the carnival barker. The real show is inside the tent, and within decades, we'll have sustained activity on the moon, asteroids, and around the Earth.
So, Kelly, what do you think of that assessment? A minor sideshow in the middle of a major destiny for space.
Yeah, you know, if you'd asked me this about 5 years ago, I would say, yeah, you know, there are these companies that are thinking of doing this. But, you know, SpaceX has become a monster in the game of space travel, not only with the rockets that it's using to launch NASA satellites and other satellites routinely and very dependably, I might add, but they have, you know, Elon Musk has big plans. He wants to help NASA land on the moon, and he wants to send his own spaceships to Mars. And I think that you combine that with what Bezos is doing with Blue Origin and also Richard Branson, Virgin Galactic. These are something that I think we hadn't really anticipated being possible in the early days of the space program. That is, individuals, not just companies, but individuals who have so much wealth and so much progressive ideas and, you know, and sort of lean, mean machines to build their own space programs. And I think that is the game changer that's underway here.
And the competition has worked. It has led to innovations and faster innovations. I mean, I never thought I would ever see a rocket land on its tail, which was something I saw in childhood on all those cartoons and science fiction movies. The government didn't do it, but Elon Musk did.
Interesting. All right, I'm going to go to the phones here. 1-800-423-8255. We've got Mark in the line in Cambridge. Mark, go ahead.
Hi, great topic. Love the show. Thank you for having me. I just wonder about what their agenda is. I love space travel. I'm a huge Star Wars fan. I personally would love to go to space. But you often wonder, you know, this privatization of space, what is their agenda? Is it to capitalize and make money? Maybe it's a space hotel. As cool as it is, I am a bit conflicted, and that's my point.
I appreciate that, Mark. I'm going to add one more voice here. We've got Jeff on the line in Hamilton. Jeff, go ahead.
Hey, how are you doing? Thanks for having me on. So for me, I think it's exciting. I think it's kind of a bummer that, you know, the world can't get it together and make this more affordable for people, but it'll inevitably happen. What I was going to say before was that, like, when the Beta thing first came out, everyone got one that was wealthy, and now everybody had a VCR, and now they all had DVDs, and, hey, today we all have digital. So inevitably, this billionaire thing happens. They're the only ones that can do space, but eventually all of us will get up there. And, I mean, if you think about it, in one of the Star Trek movies, I mean, someone from our time said, wow, this must have cost a lot of money. And then Captain Picard said, well, in our society, we do that all together. So eventually that'll happen. So I'm an optimist about it myself.
Well, and hats off to you for figuring out how to put in a Betamax reference as well there, Jeff. That was awesome. So, Marcia and Kelly, I'm going to turn back to you. Two themes there that I want to get to. One is the question of the agenda of private companies that can put themselves and their technology in space. And
right.
The other is the path of accessibility. So, Kelly, pick up on the agenda piece.
I would love to do that. And, you know, these three companies, Virgin Galactic, Blue Origin and SpaceX represent sort of variations on the theme. Virgin Galactic, they all want to make money, let's be clear, right? But there's a lot of ego here behind all of these things. Virgin Galactic only wants to send tourists into space and only on these little quick up and down flights that we saw just a couple of weeks ago. There is no way that that spacecraft will ever go into orbit. That's not their intent. It's to give a short joyride, much like the wickedest roller coaster that you've ever been on. Blue Origin is sort of in the transition phase. Right now, they're looking to do tourist jaunts. And I want to point out, that spacecraft that Bezos rode on doesn't have a pilot. It's totally automated from launch to landing. And then there's SpaceX, which is doing it all. Yes, they want to have rides into space for tourists, but that will eventually go to the space station. But they're more on the commercial side, the muscle, if you will. Right now, they're launching a lot of satellites into orbit. They have spacecraft going to the space station to take crew up there, and they're planning this gigantic starship that will eventually go to Mars. And so I think Musk, in that sense, is building both a commercial sector and then, like, in a sense, his own private interplanetary human travel business.
But what I think is missing in this equation is there needs to be a restructuring of space treaties. When space treaties were first made, it was always assumed that it was the nations that were going to carry out the space activities. But now we have these commercial enterprises. We need to have an international regulatory agency akin to a global FAA to assure their safety, to fairly distribute the limited capacity of the space around the Earth. I mean, it's getting crowded up there. In 2019, satellites launched by SpaceX and the European Space Agency almost crashed into one another because there wasn't communication between the two launches. So there needs to be oversight, and it has to be global. I mean, there are rules that you can't own the moon. But there's nothing that says anything about the resources. Now, the U.S. during the Obama administration did pass a Space Competitiveness Act, which allows U.S. companies to go to the moon, mine the resources, and keep them. But what about other countries? What if we all gather together, Russia, China, Europe, all around those areas on the moon where they think there's water? There's going to be competition, and there needs to be regulations in place. We have to start now to start regulating these companies.
How? Well, either of you, how?
So first of all, the major space powers countries already have some collaboration. And you might remember when the Chinese launched a segment for their new space station. They're a new big name in the game right now. The rocket re-entered in an uncontrolled way. And China is a signatory to this interagency consultative group, that's what they call it, that they have kind of rules of the road for this kind of stuff, and they broke those rules. And to the point, Marcia's point, I agree that there are so many new people getting into the game, new companies getting into the game, that I do think that that probably not under the United Nations, I don't think, although they have some oversight. I think there just has to be a meeting of the minds and everyone willing to cooperate so that they don't run into each other. And Marcia, you know, you mentioned the limits of what those space treaties are. Look at what SpaceX is doing with its Starlink system. Now,
oh, yes. This is, they did it without any consultation with anyone.
They do have FCC clearance, okay? Here's the thing. There is no regulation to how many spacecraft, how many satellites you can have in orbit. There's none. There's no limitation whatsoever. And so what SpaceX is doing...
So wait, just Kelly, let me give Marcia a chance to respond to the thing you just said, and then we'll come back. Marcia, go ahead.
No, I was just agreeing with Kelly that there are more than a million pieces of debris now orbiting the Earth, and they're quite dangerous, as witnessed by the movie Gravity. And also, if you read astronaut Scott Kelly's book Endurance, he tells you explicitly what would happen to the International Space Station if some big piece of debris, or even a little piece of debris, came slamming into the space station at 17,000 miles per hour. Devastating. And they have to monitor all of this debris, 85% of which no longer serves a purpose. Many of the objects that are, there's some 30,000 satellites up there, 85% are no longer serving a purpose. There has to be some traffic cops.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry. I just want to make sure, and this is hard when we're all remote, I just want to make sure to get it all in. So I'm going to come back and let Kelly pick up his thought. And Kelly, I'm just going to clarify, you mentioned Starlink. That's the 1,600-plus satellite network
SpaceX is launching. That's how many they have now. The plan is for more than 12,000 satellites. Now, the goal is to bring internet to the world. And this is not the first time we've had a constellation of satellites, if you will, to provide internet. Some of the listeners here might remember Iridium, and there have been other navigation and communication satellite networks involving, you know, dozens of satellites. But 12,000 is the plan. 1,600, as you mentioned, are already in orbit. They're going to be in sort of medium height orbits, not super far away like geosynchronous satellites. And they might not pose a risk to the International Space Station, but I can tell you that astronomers are not keen about having all these things crisscrossing in front of their, you know, trying to get pictures of galaxies and such. And Starlink is just one of many companies that are planning to do this.
All right. So I wish we had 12 hours. I'm learning so much just in this short time from the two of you. There's a couple of threads we left that I want to make sure before we run out of time we pick up. We had a caller who talked about accessibility, you know, who is going to be able to go into space. And there's another perspective that we know is out there that we haven't heard yet either. So I'm going to go back to the phones and I'm going to pick up Rowan in Worcester. Rowan, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for having me. Frankly, I think that this individual space race is a disgusting and selfish waste of money and resources. I mean, we have so many problems on Earth. Jeff Bezos could have solved world hunger, and he took himself and a teenager to space for 10 minutes.
Thank you for that perspective, Rowan. It was part of the conversation we wanted to put on the table. Kelly, Marcia, Bernie Sanders tweeted, quote, "Here on Earth, in the richest country on the planet, half our people live paycheck to paycheck. People are struggling to feed themselves, struggling to see a doctor. But hey, the richest guys in the world are off in outer space. Yes, it's time to tax the billionaires," end quote. Now, tax policy aside, there is this pushback that this is a tremendous amount of resources that could be used to be better focused here on Earth. I need to get a minute to get your reactions to that, Marcia.
Well, I will have a counterexample, and I'm thinking very long term. Eventually, we are going to run out of resources here on Earth, not to mention getting those resources can be very environmentally damaging. So if you get an asteroid and are able to net an asteroid and bring it back into Earth orbit and use those resources, you're going to be saving a large part of the Earth from getting destroyed to mine those metals and materials. So I'm thinking very long term, this will pay out. the way our explorations of the Earth did. Yes, they had poverty in London at the time that they were exploring the Earth, but eventually those resources got evened out and the poverty was solved. We have to think long-term on this, not immediate. It's very difficult, I think, to choose one project over another and say we're going to do this but not that. I think we can work in parallel.
So yeah, that it sounds optimistic. Kelly, are you equally optimistic that it will be worth the money we're not spending to solve our problems here on the ground now because of a long-term technological payout?
A couple of different things here. I mean, what I think SpaceX is doing is ultimately for the collective good, building an internet, a worldwide internet system, providing rockets that people need to launch satellites that we need. But there is a lot of criticism that's been leveled against Bezos for Blue Origin, who is spending his own money to fund this thing. He's in an argument right now with Musk about, you know, a lander to the moon. And Bezos does not have a very good track record of philanthropy. And he's been given a lot of grief over this flight, this ego flight, and for exactly the point that the caller raised, the money that he is spending on space tourism could be put to much better use for more practical and urgent needs here on the ground.
All right. So we are, I'm just looking at the clock. We have just a couple of minutes left. On balance, you both sound mostly excited and optimistic, but with a strong need for some regulation and to make sure that there is a human payout at the end of this. Marcia, is that a fair characterization?
I think that's very fair.
Wow, yeah, that was quick.
well, I do too. And what's going to happen is that sooner or later, one of these private spacecraft is going to blow up. Hopefully not with people inside, but there's going to be some kind of accident, some kind of mishap. And that will trigger a call for coordination at a greater level than we have today.
I'm an optimist. All right. I think of the overview effect. How fragile. People go up into space, and they've come back and said they see how fragile the Earth is. So maybe I'm overly optimistic, but those space tourists are rich, so they might have more political pull and deep pockets. Maybe that will speed up public policy on protecting the Earth.
Marcia, Kelly, it is such a joy to learn from the two of you. That is Marcia Bartuszak, professor of the practice emeritus at MIT and author of several books on astrophysics and astronomy, and Kelly Beattie, the senior editor of Cambridge-based Sky and Telescope. Thank you so much to both of you.
A pleasure.
Thank you.
We're a community here at WBUR, and a big part of that community for almost 30 years has been Morning Edition host Bob Oakes. Now, I know I have spent a quarter of a century relying on Bob in the mornings to help me start my day every morning listening for him. Well, as you probably know, Bob's starting a new chapter in the fall. Don't worry, he will get a proper chance to celebrate and say goodbye with us here on Radio Boston, and I'm sure many other places too. But today we want to share a little exciting news. Rupa Shenoy will be the next host of WBUR's Morning Edition. She covers human rights around the globe for PRX's The World, is the creator and host of the PRI podcast Otherhood, and has reported for GBH and Minnesota Public Radio. And we just wanted to give Rupa a big Radio Boston hello for a minute. So Rupa, welcome to Team WBUR.
Thank you so much. That's really kind of you. I really appreciate it.
It is great to have you, and it's great to meet you. So listen, I gave a quick rundown there, but I want you to say hello to our listeners. The 3 o'clock audience here on BUR might not know you from 3 o'clock in the world, on the world on GBH. So say hello to your new Team WBUR community.
Hi, Boston. I'm really honored to be the next person who's going to help you in the morning, get ready for your day, and I'm really looking forward to, you know, being part of your community.
So, Rupa, why Boston? What's drawing you to us? And what's drawing you to Morning Edition?
Boston is...
Oh, no! I think we just lost Rupa. Don't worry, that is not an omen of things to come. That is just that we don't have her here yet in our studios, and I think we're going to try to get her back. But if we don't, everybody will have a good chuckle over our attempt to bring new Rupa Morning Edition host into the fold with us, and then lose her on sound. That'll be a story that we will be able to tell for years to come. I think we're going to get her back. Rupa, are you there?
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Oh, God, that's funny. Oh, no, it's funny. Okay, so listen, tell us why Boston and why Morning Edition?
Why Boston is an incredible question because obviously it's Boston. Boston is so layered, so has so much character, has so much history. It's exciting, and it has so much going on now. And why Morning Edition? I mean, I tend to think it's the most important time of my day. It's when I want to know everything I need to know for the day. And the person that I listen to, like Bob Oakes, for years at that time, is kind of a friend, the reliable person in my life. And it's amazing to be that for other people.
So, Rupa, what's your goal? What do you want to bring to your and your team's Morning Edition when you join us in the fall formally?
I tend to be myself all the time. So you're going to hear me, who I am. And I have always made it a priority to cover human rights, to unearth voices that don't usually get heard. And I'm going to hope to do that in Morning Edition as well. I mean,
Sorry, we lost Rupa again there. So again, we will have a chuckle about this later when we regularly hear from Rupa here on WBUR. That was Rupa Shenoy, who will be the host of WR's Morning Edition starting in the fall. From afar, Rupa, welcome. We're so happy to have you, and I'm glad you could talk to us for just a few minutes today. All right, stay tuned, folks. We will be back. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. The Olympics can be magical. Athletes from all over the world competing at their best to be the best. And there is something even more inspiring when we know the athletes high up on that pedestal come from close to home. Christy Wagner and Jevie Stone do. The rowing pair hails from Weston and Newton, and they came in fifth in their final race this week. We caught up with them earlier today to talk competition, mental health, and more, and I started out by asking them how that final race felt.
We had big goals, and, you know, we put together a solid race, and, you know, I think we were a little bit sad that our best race didn't result in a medal, but, you know, we had a really good campaign, and I think we're proud of, you know, the effort that we put forward. And, you know, it's really exciting to race in the Olympic final. It was my first time, and that's, you know, as big as the sport gets in rowing. So it just feels really cool to have competed on that stage.
Yeah.
Jeff, anything you'd add?
Yeah, it was my last time. So I think as hard as it is, I was reminding myself, in addition to about technique and get my right arm straight and get the blade squared up, I just kept telling myself, enjoy every stroke.
You two were not a team until relatively recently. Is that correct, Christy?
Yes. We both raced in February in singles. And then kind of in the beginning of March, we came together and started rowing together. So we've only been rowing together since then, which is pretty unusual for the Olympics. But actually in our event here, there were quite a few newer combinations, which is interesting, but also probably makes sense given the like pandemic year and how long it's been since the last international competition.
So Jevie, did that affect how you trained? Did it affect how well you guys got to know each other? Talk about that a little bit, being a new team.
Everyone's training is slightly different, but it really does all go with a theme. And Christy came to Boston and jumped in with our training group. We had six girls between singles trials and doubles trials, and Christy jumped right into that training plan. She did a great job adapting to that, and we definitely did make an effort to check in once a week and to get to know one another. Went for some walks by the river and sat on the bench and went to breakfast. And it's been really fun because we approached training and racing in a similar way even before we met each other. And we've only, that bond has gotten stronger over the last couple of months in terms of being on the same page and looking for the same things.
You both are from the area originally, Weston and Newton. Was there something about training here that made a difference? And did you draw on your home communities or things your home communities had done for you when you were younger that got you to where you are?
I think training in Boston for the, you know, couple of months leading up to this for me were really fun and really special. Jevy's, you know, been training on the Charles for a long time, and she's really gathered this group of, you know, other elite scholars, but also masters rowers, which is our word for adult recreational rowers who sometimes take it very seriously and will do Olympic training with some Olympians at 6 a.m. Before they go to work. So it's been awesome. And in our weeks leading up to coming to Tokyo, different crews would stop and cheer for us and applaud for us on the water, which was really cool and just made training so special. And you know, we felt the love even all the way on the other side of the world.
Jevy, it's so great to hear Christy say that. I admit that I guess I was imagining tremendous strain, having to sort of train for an extra year and stay in peak form once you'd sort of gotten to peak form before the Olympics were postponed, I'm assuming. But it sounds like it was on balance a positive experience.
Yeah, the extra year was certainly a challenge. My group in Boston took everything down a notch in terms of intensity and stress last spring because we knew that we couldn't do 2 years of Olympic year training. It would just break us not only physically, but also mentally.
Let's talk about that mental bit a little bit. Those of us who are not there are certainly watching from afar. And with U.S. gymnast Simone Biles withdrawing from the team all around, a team and all around competitions, really brought awareness to the mental health strains. Has that resonated with the two of you? And what should people understand about the mental health needs of peak athletes, especially in such high-pressure competitions?
I think it's really easy as an athlete to integrate how you do performance-wise into how you feel about yourself as a person and equate results to your confidence. Personally, I think it's hard to separate the two because we spend so much time thinking about our sport, doing our sport. We care about our sport. We're obviously doing it because we love it. But results are not who we are as a human. And being able to separate the emotion and human needs and the character side of things from the performance side of things, I think, helps to keep at it and keep a level head, even when times get stressful and maybe don't go as planned. I mean, from what I was reading, and I don't know, Simone was just reading some articles, but it sounds like she internalized a lot of external stressors and put a lot of weight on herself. We have to love what we do to perform because sometimes that's what makes the difference, because what we do is grueling. And so it has to be something that we enjoy and love and care about and have fun doing ultimately.
I do want to talk about Tokyo now. And Christy, I guess I'll turn to you. It's your first Olympic adventure. Very unusual circumstances there. What is it like to compete in your first games, you know, in these games?
You know, rowing is definitely not the most spectator popular sport. So, and because I've never raced in the Olympics before, like, I mean, I've heard stories about how in London there were, you know, fans over the entire 2K course, which is a mile and a quarter. So that's a lot of cheering. And, you know, I can imagine that being really special, but for the majority of our races, you know, our parents are literally breaking into parks to come and watch us race. Like, it, people don't come. So it didn't feel that weird to me because I've, you know, had some of the most important days of my rowing career in front of nobody. That being said, I think it is sad that, you know, our family and friends couldn't be here to experience this with us, because you can't get to the Olympics by yourself. And it takes a lot of people in your corner. And I know Jevy and I both have a lot of people in our corners. And it's sad that we couldn't share this experience in person with all of them. I mean, just tying it into the mental side, I think it is hard being, you know, around the world. And when we wake up, our family and friends back home are going to bed. So we can only, you know, talk to people back home for really brief periods of time during the day. And when, you know, you're having some of the most important races of your life, it's hard not to be able to call up a friend and spend a few minutes, you know, going through something. So I understand why it's been such a challenge for a lot of athletes here.
Yeah. The only thing I'd add to that is too bad that the world can't share with Japan, because I think you've done an amazing job hosting this games in terms of the organization, the helpfulness, the enthusiasm of everyone we meet in terms of like ushering us into the dining hall and making sure we use sanitizer hands and
every volunteer is amazing and awesome and so excited to be here and so excited to be doing it. And that also makes it feel really cool. And, you know, the little bit of Japanese culture that we've been able to interact with has been awesome.
It's too bad they can't, the world doesn't get to see that.
What comes next for each of you? Jevy, I understand you're going to trade the skull back in for a stethoscope because you took years off of your medical residency at Beth Israel Deaconess. Is that right?
That is correct. I start again August 16th.
Are you excited about that? Is it trepidation?
Yeah, I think for me, rowing has been a huge part of my life for the last decade plus. A lot of who I am is tied to that. And I think about rowing when I wake up and I think about rowing when I fall asleep. And it's going to take some getting used to not having that. And I'm really glad that I have something else that I care about to throw myself into, because I think that the transition would be much harder if I didn't have medicine and something else, another challenge, something else I'm excited about ahead of me.
Are you done rowing?
I am. Well, not done rowing, but done rowing at this level. I'll never be done rowing.
And Christy, what's next for you?
I mean, I'm definitely going to take a little bit of time and, you know, process this past couple of weeks, but also the past year or so. It's funny, I said to one of my friends the other day, like, and finally, 2020 is over, because in a lot of ways, we've still been living in 2020. You know, it's plastered everywhere around us. And that was a really hard year for a lot of people. And we added, you know, 6 months to it. So I'm excited for a little bit of downtime and be able to spend time with friends and family. And, you know, I'm not exactly sure what I'm going to do next, but I feel very equipped to handle whatever it is.
Let's look a little more short term. What is the first thing you're both going to do when you get home?
Well, we have a 3-hour layover in the Chicago airport, and I'm really hoping they have an ice cream store in there, because that's one thing the Olympic Village didn't really have. And we're both pretty big ice cream fans. So that's going to be exciting.
Yeah.
All right. Jevy Stone of Newton and Christy Wagner of Weston, both are members of the U.S. Olympic rowing team. They've joined us from Tokyo. Jevy, Christy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us tomorrow for Radio Boston's Week in Review.